Support for NPR comes from Heather and Paul Haga, supporting Salzburg Global Seminar, committed to helping tomorrow's leaders forge solutions today. More information is available online at salzburgglobal.org. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
Support comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas. Blood donations historically decrease in the summer. Students hosting CBCC summer blood drives can earn college scholarships. Details at cbcc.us.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. A year from now, we should know who the presidential nominees for both the Republican and Democratic parties are. But between now and then, the crowded fields of candidates will see their poll numbers swing up and down. They'll be taking sides on controversial issues and starting their long march to the White House in November 2016. Today, we've convened a panel of political experts to help guide us through the handful of Democratic contenders and the baker's dozen so far of Republicans vying for their party's nomination, along with discussing the role that the Carolinas might play in determining who will lead their party's tickets. Joining us are three regulars to the show. In studio is Dr. Susan Roberts, Associate Professor of Political Science at Davidson College, where she teaches on the presidency, Congress, political parties, campaigns, and interest groups. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
Dr. Scott Huffman returns from an appearance on Friday, and he is a professor of political science at Winthrop University in Rock Hill, where he founded and directs the Social and Behavioral Research Laboratory and where he conducts the Winthrop Poll. His teaching and research focus are on public opinion, Southern politics, religion and politics, and campaigns and elections, among many other areas. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone is Dr. Jason Husser, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Elon University and Assistant Director of the Elon Poll. His research interests are in American political behavior and survey research methodology, and his current research examines the role of partisan polarization on American religious behavior. Good morning, Jason.
Morning.
We want to hear from our listeners as well. Are you pleased with the field of candidates for both political parties? Is there someone you want to see throw their hat into the ring who hasn't? And what issues do you think will decide the ultimate nomination for both the Democrats and the Republicans? Join us on WFAE's Facebook page. Send us an email to charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can send us a tweet or go to our homepage, WFAE.org. I want to start off this morning just by kind of going around the panel here. And Jason, I want to start with you first. How would you break down the overall fields within both parties? I mean, do we see kind of specific groups of candidates, particularly on the Republican side with 13 candidates potentially going up to 16? How do you see the contest kind of shaping up at this point?
Well, I'll quickly summarize my view of the Democratic side, which is easy, which is Hillary Clinton and then no one else. Not just everybody else, no one else.
Nobody else. Why nobody else?
It doesn't seem that there's really any viable candidate running against her. It's almost as if people are hoping they'll get a chance to be her vice presidential candidate at this point. The Republican side, though, we do see a couple, two to three front runners. Jeb Bush, obviously, central among those, Marco Rubio. And then there's some debatable front runner like, you know, Mike Huckabee, Scott Walker. I'm not sure exactly where these folks are, but they do seem to stand a chance. It's really Jeb Bush, and then there's this big middle ground with folks like Rick Perry, Rand Paul, and then a pretty soft base with Carly Fiorina and others.
Okay. Susan?
Well, I think I was watching last night, I think it was HBO, the show The 70s, and it was showing the Watergate, and I kept thinking, would something like this unravel with Hillary Clinton? I think not, but when you think about 15 emails are missing, that's not a large number, but they must be significant. I agree with Jason, Hillary Clinton and really nobody else. Bernie Sanders is making a lot of noise, pushing her a little bit, capturing the imagination. And then on the Republican side, I still think that it'll be the dynasty duo with Bush winning the nomination. I think he's positioning himself right now for the general election. But I think that, Walker and Rubio are really the people that are going to, take him on. I think you've got the religious with Santorum and Huckabee. But I don't think that's not going to have the traction that the social conservatives would like.
Okay. Scott?
Well, with Hillary, you know, Sanders is playing an important role in sort of challenging her, getting big crowds. But it's really not going to go that much further than that. And she needs to hope it doesn't go terribly further, because she needs to not track too far left to position herself for the general election. However, she also does really need some competition so that it doesn't seem like this is just a victory lap, a coronation of the inevitable. So she needs some legitimate competition. She doesn't need Bernie Sanders pulling her to the left, unless, of course, you're a Republican, then you really want Bernie Sanders pulling her further to the left. I think Jim Webb took himself out of it. I thought, even though he's kind of boring in public appearances, he's pretty solid until he came out protecting the Confederate flag. And you're just really not going to do well in the Democratic primary, especially, you know, you come to South Carolina where half of the voters in the Democratic primary are African-Americans. You're just not going to do that well. O'Malley, folks just don't know who he is. I think the most interesting thing is we've heard stories that said before he passed, Biden's son wanted him to get in and make one more run at the White House. I think a challenge by Joe Biden would be probably the most interesting that matchup that we could see. Mm-hmm. If Hillary still comes out on top, that legitimizes her victory, I think, in a way that would position her for the general election. As far as the Republicans, you do have a handful of top vote getters. Mm-hmm. It's different region by region who's kind of winning the race. You have that middle that Jason talked about, and that's where you're going to see a lot of interesting movement, because they're going to fight tooth and nail to move up, and it's always going to have to be at the expense of somebody else. The farther we get along in the process, the fewer undecided you have, and so at that point it becomes a zero-sum game, and the only way for you to get blood infused into your campaign is to draw it from your opponents. And so we're going to see, especially the Cruises, the Christies, they're going to sharpen their knives on their fellow Republicans, I think, in the next month.
So basically violate Reagan's 11th commandment of not saying anything ill about any fellow Republicans. They're all going to go after each other. Does everybody agree that Jeb Bush is the front runner at this point, or Scott's kind of maybe not?
I don't think he's on a pinnacle. I think he is definitely in a top tier, and in most polls show him kind of edging out a few. But a lot of those polls, he's within the margin of error of the others. I think he is the best known, so the best position to build on his base. He has the best fundraising apparatus, and he is perhaps first among equals in the top tier. But I wouldn't argue that he's on a pinnacle that's unreachable.
I also think that people have criticized Bush for not having the enthusiasm to run. I mean, why is he running? Is it because there's no one else there? He's got the name recognition, the money, the organization, and he's been the most cautious when it comes to commenting on the flag issue, on same-sex marriage, on the issues about Obamacare. I don't know who that his base is going to be. He's running for the general election. The other candidates for the Republicans are running for the nomination. They're running a primary campaign, and he seems to be running that general election campaign. I think if you looked at, and I just happened to look, his sign, it's Jeb with exclamation point. Mm-hmm. Then there's Bernie, and then there's Rand, and then there's Carly. Well, I think Carly probably wants to be like Hillary. Rand Paul and Jeb Bush want to forget their fathers, and Bernie's just Bernie.
Bernie is Bernie. All right, we'll talk. We'll talk more about Bernie and others a little bit later. Jason, y'all had an Elon poll, I think, at the beginning of the month, and particularly looking nationally and within the state of North Carolina. Tell us a little bit about what y'all found. Is it indeed the dynasty duo? Is it Hillary versus Jeb, or what did y'all find?
The dynasty effect's interesting in our results. We did an online poll, which is a bit unusual, but we had some images we wanted to show related to Supreme Court cases. That's why we used that method. But here are the terms most commonly associated with candidates. So for Bush, it was Bush, good, okay, brother, like, best, family, and George, in that order. So there's a lot of mention about these dynasty effects. With Hillary, it was strong president, good, like, Bill, and then first female president, and then great. So you didn't see nearly as many terms associated with families or dynasties with Clinton as you did with Bush. Rubio is also looking pretty good in terms of these words people associate with candidates. With Rubio, the words in order of frequency were good, okay, young, maybe, great, Hispanic, and not sure. In some ways, I would rather have those words that Rubio has than the words Bush has.
Why?
They were words that allowed him to shape his own image. And so in many ways, Bush needs to define himself based on that he's not the undesirable parts of his brother, or that he is the good parts of his brother or his father. Whereas Rubio really has this opportunity to say he's young and great and good in other ways.
Okay.
Well, I think, too, as Jason points out, Rubio can legitimately have that quote-unquote narrative, whereas Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton can't get that narrative of pull yourself up from your bootstraps, work so hard. And that's been very effective for voters to look at personality. Right now, the instances, which I'm sure we'll talk about with the court decisions in Baltimore and Charleston, are forcing the candidates on the Republican side, not so much the Democratic side, to go to policy stands and not just personality. They will be united in criticizing President Obama. It was the best week for President Obama. It was the legacy week. How it shapes for the Republican Party and the candidates remains to be seen, and it's not as easy as it looks, and I'm sure we'll talk about the impact.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about the events of last week, because it did seem, particularly on Thursday and Friday, that the Supreme Court became kind of the centerpiece and the focus of the nation's attention. Certainly, we were still dealing with Charleston. The funeral that was held on Friday that President Obama was at was very powerful, but really from a policy standpoint for these presidential candidates, ultimately perhaps 16 Republicans, the Supreme Court handed down some decisions that I would have to say the battle lines are probably already pretty clearly set between Democrats and Republicans. It seemed like the Chief Justice on the Affordable Care Act, on what is commonly called Obamacare, really gave the Republicans a kind of outcry almost about the decision there, because he upheld it and they kind of came out and just blasted one of their own. Scott, was this, something to be expected?
Well, I thought you were going to talk about the Marvel case with Spider-Man.
We'll get to that later in the show. Yes.
The interesting thing about, all of this is it's coming from a conservative court. That are more conservative, more Republican appointees. Also on the Affordable Care Act, I think a lot of folks were assuming that if it came down and upheld the Affordable Care Act, it was going to be based on the Chevron decision, which basically said either if you can't tell by the absolute language, then you have to defer to the way the executive is implementing it to get and that's not how the decision was made. And in fact, the decision seemed to be made in a way that it has to be interpreted this way in the broader context of what was written, because the impact on the country and the economy would be too great otherwise. And so that maybe actually opens the door for other policy decisions down the road that could go ways Republicans would like, especially some EPA decisions. That said, what this case has handed the Republicans is fodder for the red meat Republicans who are going to be attending their rallies, who are most likely to vote in the primaries. This and, of course, the same-sex decision that we'll get to in a minute are kind of the touchstones of every one of these town meetings. And it's going to get the base fired up. And we're going to hear it all through the primary. General election, different question.
Okay. We'll talk about the difference between the primary and the general election and certainly talk about the same-sex decision that the Supreme Court handed down. That was Scott Huffman from Winthrop University joining us with Susan Roberts from Davidson and Jason Husser from Elon University. We'll be back after this. This is Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Gerald Melberg Gallery, currently presenting a survey exhibition for the abstract expressionist artist Robert Motherwell, celebrating the 100th anniversary of his birth, located on South Sharon Amity Road. Information at geraldmelberg.com. Well, tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, guest host Chris Clackham will sit down with a man who's called on anytime there are questions about Charlotte area history. Tom Hanchett is retiring, though, as staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New South. He'll still be around teaching Charlatteans and visitors alike, but as he starts this new chapter in his life, we'll talk to him about his long career, what's next for him, and all the changes in the Queen City that he's witnessed firsthand. That's when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, California lawmakers approve a mandatory vaccine bill. If signed into law, it will be one of the toughest in the nation. The push to require vaccinations and the tension between public health and personal beliefs.
That's the Diane Rehm Show, coming up next from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-supported 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking with Jason Husser from Elon University, Susan Roberts from Davidson College, and Scott Huffman from Winthrop University. We were talking about the ACA, and Susan, I want to get your opinion on it. It seemed like establishment Republicans quietly were praising the court for getting it off the Republicans have to deal with, but the candidates again are really kind of hammering this, you know, repeal and replace with what we don't know. What was your impression of?
I think the dominant phrase was repeal and replace. Ted Cruz said, this is going to be the cornerstone of my campaign. I don't think it's a cornerstone. It's one of the stones of his campaign. And I think for some Republicans, they want to move on. I think the Republican Party is confused about how really to use it. But it's very easy for them to say, it's been decided. Let's, several of them, Jindal as one of them, let's fire the Supreme Court, which sounds like Ross Perot a while back. But I think that it is one of those that people have said, common sense, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton. I think once you get down the line, it is more repeal and replace, and it is judicial activism, and it is the court can't make these decisions. What are we going to do? Bush, his father and his brother, total three Supreme Court justices mm-hmm. appointed, and that's going to be a little difficult for him to really come out and talk about the court as the culprit. I think that for many people, too, looking at Obamacare, the Republicans haven't come up with a solution. I'm not sure how they would distinguish one from another, the solutions, but it's also easy to say states' rights. That's something that I think many of the candidates are doing, both about same-sex marriage as well as the Affordable Care Act.
Jason, what did your poll find out about Obamacare?
We asked back in February last about Obamacare. There was overall a great deal of pessimism in North Carolina. So 49.3% of registered voters thought the ACA would make things worse. Only 35% thought they'd make things better, and 10% thought it didn't make much difference. However, that opinion on ACA was very divided along partisan lines. 67% of Democrats thought the ACA would make the health care situation in North Carolina better. Only 5% of Republicans did. To me, that tells me that this decision will activate those primary voters and make the primary even more intense than it would have been otherwise.
Do you think that, and I'll open it up to anybody, do you think with John Roberts writing that majority opinion that particularly for Jeb Bush, whose brother appointed him as Chief Justice, is that going to be another hammer against Jeb that everybody else will pull the knives out and say, look, you're part of a family that appointed the guy that has saved the ACA twice now? Is that going to be a kind of ammunition for the rest of the crowd to turn on Jeb?
A quick answer. It will be ammunition for the rest of the crowd, the rest of the Republican hopefuls. It will not be an issue when you get to the general election because there you're going to have people, and this doesn't mean they're ill-informed. You will have less sophisticated voters that will pick on one or two other things besides that connection. They may pick on the connection between the Bushes, but they won't go so deep as to see that as something that will hurt them. The easy target is Obama in this and the legacy of Obama. Do you want more of that? And that will be the thing that unites both of those decisions. It's going to be directed at the court and President Obama and then Hillary Clinton.
Okay. Scott, you were shaking.
Well, you know, it's kind of difficult because to once they're going after Obamacare with this full-throated attack, to then say, and it was the Chief Justice nominated by his brother, they're actually attacking George W. Bush. And that's a little iffy, attacking the last Republican president that you had. However, I do think they will find a way to use it to sort of till the soil so that there are other attacks on him, such as about Common Core, about his views on immigration, both of which are in opposition to most of the rest of the field. So I think it'll be kind of part of a tilling the ground for anti-Jeb sentiment in which they'll plant the seeds that they hope will grow into weeds that will obscure his chances and that they can use for their own climbing ahead over him.
Okay. We're talking about last week's Supreme Court decisions and the impact on the presidential candidates. We want to hear from you. What do you think about the list of presidential wannabes that are taking shape, and how do you think these cases from last week are going to impact their runs? You can make your comments on Facebook or on Twitter at WFAE. Let's get to the second big decision of last week, and that was on same-sex marriage. It was a very controversial decision, 5-4. The conservatives all lined up against it on the court, and it was indeed the swing candidate, swing Justice Anthony Kennedy, appointed by Ronald Reagan, the kind of godfather of the Republican Party now. But in talking about the same-sex marriage, Ted Cruz, U.S. Senator from Texas, described it as the worst 24 hours in American history. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee and current Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal have said to simply ignore the court or do away with it, perhaps put them up for retention elections. But this public opinion has shifted so fast on this particular issue. Are they truly just trying to appeal to the social evangelical conservatives within the Republican base? How is this going to play out if they go that far? And then if one of them becomes the nominee, then they have to compete in the general election.
Well, that's the classic two constituencies problem. You have to run all the way to the left if you're a Democrat, or all the way to the right if you're a Republican for that constituency during the primary. Mm-hmm. Then the general election constituency, because we have a moderate unimodal electorate, most people are kind of in the middle, you have to run back to the center. And so we have the main candidates who are running against each other at that point are candidate A and candidate A in the primary, because you're juxtaposing, you know, everybody's calling everybody a liar because of what they said 2 months ago. So it is going to be difficult to carry these positions forward and win over the majority of the public, which is shifting gears, shifting its attitudes about same-sex marriage. That said, There are so many candidates in the Republican field that nobody can put all of their eggs in one single basket. So the evangelicals are not going to win for any candidate, but so all the candidates need to claw away a few of the evangelicals. Several of the candidates need to do their best to claw away some of the Tea Party. So there's not going to be one path because there's too many candidates. Everybody's going to have to claw away a little bit of the constituency and build a coalition. Everybody's coalition is going to be different. There's not going to be a lot of Tea Party in, say, Jeb Bush's coalition. Mm-hmm. But the evangelicals, Cruz is going to go after him. Huckabee's going to go after him. Jindal's going after him.
Rick Santorum.
Rick Santorum's going after him. So, you know, at that point, it's okay, if I think that evangelicals are going to be an important part of my base, I've got to be the most vehement. I've got to say that these 24 hours were worse than when the towers fell and the Pentagon was hit, that this is the worst 24 hours, mm-hmm. not the terrorist attacks. I've got to use hyperbole and, frankly, start using apocalyptic language to say these are the end times we've been talking about. You've got to elect me president or else America's in its downfall.
Okay. On the Democratic side, it seemed like the presidential candidates couldn't endorse the decisions quick enough. But just a reminder, the front runner on the Democratic side said this in 2004 when she was in the U.S. Senate.
I believe that marriage is not just a bond, but a sacred bond between a man and a woman. I have had occasion in my life to defend marriage, to stand up for marriage, to believe in the hard work and challenge of marriage. So I take umbrage at anyone who might suggest that those of us who worry about amending the Constitution are less committed to the sanctity of marriage or to the fundamental bedrock principle that it exists between a man and a woman going back into the mists of history as one of the foundational institutions of history and humanity and civilization, and that its primary principal role during those millennia has been the raising and socializing of children for the society into which they are to become adults.
And that was Hillary Clinton in 2004. Now she has basically just came out effusive over the policy. Jason, I want to get to you first and then hit Susan about what do we see this issue in North Carolina and particularly in your poll nationally about?
What a difference a decade makes listening to former Secretary of State's comments there. I mean, you had to think she was thinking about 2008 when she was making those remarks. Gay marriage is obviously going to show up, but I don't think after this ruling it will be as big of an issue as it could have been. We found that 48% of registered voters in North Carolina opposed gay marriage, while only 42% supported it. That is lower than national polls have found. So Pew, most recently in 2015, found favorability towards same-sex marriage at 57%, opposition at 39%. Not surprisingly, North Carolina is slightly more conservative than the nation as a whole on that matter.
Susan?
Well, I think if that were an argument that Hillary made, I would give it a C+, and that would be a general C+ in one of my classes, because you want to say, what are you trying to say? Just say it. Get to the point.
Right.
I think for Hillary Clinton, she's going to have to face the fact that there have been different definitions of the sanctity of marriage in her past. If you look at, too, going back to the Republicans for just a moment, Bush said that the court erred, but we've got to love thy neighbor. Mm-hmm. Scott Walker said we need to look at a constitutional amendment. Rubio said, we live in a republic, so we have to obey the law. But one thing that I found that I think is worth mentioning is Priebus, the chair of the Republican National Committee, was very guarded in what he said in terms of, he said, we need to respect those that are involved in this decision, the religious view and the religious people that we're talking about as voters, but we also need to respect those that were happy about the other side, and that you need to find a common ground. That's very safe, and that will help in the general election. And I think he's trying to cover the Republican Party from some of the people that, as Huckabee said, you know, this is, you can't overturn God and bring it such, you know, not generally apocalyptic, but also full throttle religion. Iowa and New Hampshire have had same-sex marriage legal since 2005. And as we've pointed out, the primary voter is very different from the general election voter. And I think it might play there. But in fact, that the states themselves have said it's okay, New Hampshire and Iowa.
And Iowa and New Hampshire are certainly the first two. Iowa caucuses, traditionally the first. New Hampshire is always the first in the nation primary. But then they go to South Carolina. How is this issue going to play, particularly among Republicans, with this Supreme Court decision? How do you think this is going to play out?
It's going to play out very, very well for the Republicans, because it's very nice to have an enemy. It's very nice to be screaming at have something to point your vitriol at. Mm-hmm. And they're going to do that. And they're going to find a welcome base among conservatives in South Carolina who do not like same-sex marriage at all. I think it'll be interesting on the Democratic side, because when you come to South Carolina in the Democratic primary, half of the Democratic primary voters in South Carolina are African-Americans, and African-Americans tend to be more religious. And they also do not always tend to support same-sex marriage. However, all of the Democratic candidates they're going to be choosing among are going to support same-sex marriage. So Hillary Clinton is going to give an Obama-esque answer, saying her feelings have evolved on the issue. Mm-hmm. It'll be some variant of that. And when you come to South Carolina on the Democratic side, all the candidates are going to have that, even though the Democratic candidates might not be – they're going to be tolerant of same-sex marriage, maybe not as tolerant as Democrats in New Hampshire. On the Republican side, it's going to play very well, because every candidate's going to get to stand up let me rephrase that. Every candidate who is going absolutely full bore after the evangelical vote is going to be able to shout about how America is going down the tubes, and the only way you can save it is to elect me.
And what role will social conservatives, evangelical voters play in the primary electorate for the Republicans? Are they a majority of these folks, or are they substantial plurality? What role are they going to show?
They are. Obviously, it's among the Republicans, it is almost all Christian, virtually all Christian. And then among the Christians, it's over two-thirds, I think, consider themselves evangelical, using the simplest measure of that. Mm-hmm. Just asking themselves whether they consider themselves evangelical or born-again Christian. And, as those who study religion and politics, there's actually multiple questions you could ask to get a more fine-grained response. But the thing is, they are not going to all pull behind one candidate. So the impact they're going to have is not necessarily being the one lump that puts one candidate over another. They are going to be important because they are going to drive the dialogue. All the candidates are going to have to speak to issues that they care about. So the issues of discussion, the issues of debate are going to be driven by social conservative, evangelical wants, needs, desires, far more than they are going to be offering up a single lump vote to put one candidate over another.
Jason, we're coming up on a break, but I want to get your input on this, particularly about North Carolina and the role of social conservatives potentially in the primary here in this state.
We have fewer than Scott has across the border. So in North Carolina, we ask a series of questions related to religion. The question Scott asked, very similar to ours, which is, some people think of themselves as evangelical or born-again Christians. Do you ever consider yourself in either of these ways? We find 17% of registered voters in the state identify as born-again Protestants. Another 54%, though, identify as Protestant but not born-again. So the social conservative Christian voters are making up most of the Republican primary. That said, they are passionate. The conservative ones are passionate about these issues, but the level of fervor is lower than it would be in South Carolina, and there's more opportunities for candidates to focus on other things, such as taxes or things that aren't necessarily appealing just to a moral base.
Okay. So, and now North Carolina had planned to be right after the South Carolina primary, but now it looks like the state is going to move it back towards, I believe it's March. Is that right, Jason?
Yeah. My understanding is Super Tuesday on March 1st.
Okay. So we'll have both Carolinas kind of early on. This is different from North Carolina than in the past, right, Susan?
It sure is. And I think that's, you know, it's amazing that the Republican Party had a blueprint about how to win the next presidential election. And the candidates are violating every precept. They said, let's not have leapfrogging in terms of the primaries. They said, let's go after the younger voters, the millennial voters. Let's be an open tent, so to speak, for the Latino voters. Let's use technology. Now, they're doing all right with the technology. You know, you can Twitter your opening to announce your campaign, mm-hmm. which I thought Jindal was a little bit on the meek side. What do you have? You know, that's very non-eventful. It's an unevent.
Okay. We're talking about presidential politics and campaigns here in the primary season. What do you want to hear from the candidates? Are the candidates that you want in the race? Join us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Paula Poundstone July 11th at Knight Theater. A regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, she has her own distinctive brand of wry, intelligent, and witty comedy. Tickets at 704-372-1000. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, many Americans are celebrating the Supreme Court's landmark decision affirming the right of same-sex couples to marry. Analysis of the decision, how critics are reacting, and what it means for the nation at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. That's right after Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE. If you'd like to join in on today's Charlotte Talks about the 2016 presidential race, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be right back.
Next time on Marketplace, a live show from the Aspen Ideas Festival. Ted Sarandos from Netflix, dancer Charles Little Buck Riley. Marketplace from Aspen. It's from APM.
Join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on listener-funded public radio. We're 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-supported 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE up in Hickory. I'm Michael Bitzer, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking about presidential primaries and those folks who want to be in the White House come 2017 with Scott Huffman of Winthrop University, Susan Roberts of Davidson College, and Jason Husser from Elon University. The role that Southerners are playing in both parties, but certainly on the Republican side. If you look at just the candidates, you've got Ted Cruz, Rick Perry from Texas. You've got Bobby Jindal from Louisiana. You've got Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio from Florida. And you've got Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. The role that the South is playing in this process, and Jason referred to Super Tuesday, kind of a regional primary process. Jason, start us off. Talk about the role that the South plays, particularly in the Republican Party, and what that may mean for any eventual nominee going into the general election.
It's fairly remarkable the states that show up earliest in the Republican primary. So, of course, there's Iowa, New Hampshire. But then you move South Carolina, then the brief Nevada. But then Super Tuesday is almost like a Southern primary now. It's Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, and we'll even throw in that partially Southern state, Oklahoma, to the mix. There's a lot of Southern conservative appeals that a Republican candidate is going to have to make. I'm interested in North Carolina. In terms of our candidates going to try to piggyback and do South Carolina to North Carolina visits, that would probably have different rhetoric than if they were trying to speak to Virginia and North Carolina audiences at the same time.
Scott?
Yeah, and they will, simply because of Charlotte. I mean, I've gotten to see all the presidential candidates in the past because they fly into Charlotte, speak there, they come to Rock Hill, and it's been great. But Jason's on to something. That whole regional primary is important for the Republican Party for a particular reason. listen, if you look at the Electoral College, if you sweep, if you're a Republican and you sweep the entire 11 state South in the Electoral College in the general election, you have approximately 59% of all the Electoral College votes you need to become president. And you only need 29% of all other Electoral College votes in the entire rest of the country. So the type of Republican who can sweep the South is the type of Republican who will win the White House. In fact, in the modern era, any Republican who has swept the South became president. Any Democrat who cracked the South with at least two states became president. So the role of all those Southerners who are running for president are they are arguably the kind of candidates in their mind who can appeal to Southerners. And if they can sweep the South, then they've got nearly 60% of the Electoral College votes they need. They only need less than 30% of all other Electoral College votes. So we are stunningly important to the Republican Party. But interestingly, we're important to the Democratic Party as well. Is South Carolina, the first in the South primary, as I mentioned, half of the Democratic primary voters are black, and African-Americans are such an important part of any Democratic winning coalition, it's the first test of African-American support. So, you know, if we're assuming Hillary's going to get it, then what South Carolina will show is can she excite the same base that propelled Barack Obama into the White House, or is she not exciting enough to do that, and will she have to find other avenues? So we're important for the Democratic side as well, but the Republicans, as Jason pointed out, we are so important, especially around that Super Tuesday, as to what kind of candidate, conservative candidate, can appeal to the entire South.
All right. So you had George W. Bush in 2000 and 2004, a Southern governor. You then had John McCain from the desert Southwest. You then had Mitt Romney from Massachusetts. Is it incumbent upon Republicans to have someone, like Scott said, from the base of the party to be able to unify this region together and have that electoral advantage, Susan? Well,
I agree completely. And then you throw in Florida, which is not, you know, it's arguably a southern state, and Ohio. But what's interesting this time around is that if you look at the battle for Texas, Cruz and Rick Perry, who many people say is still in the mix, and you look at Florida, the race between Rubio and Bush, how's that going to play out? And I don't think, and I think he's been one of the members of the Senate who has really tried bipartisanship when he wasn't up for reelection, Lindsey Graham. South Carolina is not Lindsey Graham's for the taking. I think that, and Scott might disagree, but I think that you look at all these, and it's going to be interesting with the dynamics within the South as well as how they frame the message. And the African-American voter, I don't know that there's much that the Republicans can do if the African-American voter is going to go Democratic. What I'm interested in is how Hillary Clinton and others are going to frame the gun issue. If it's framed in terms of gun violence, there's a chance. But I think the Southerners still like those, God and guns, and they don't like gays.
Scott, let me pick up on the conversation you had Friday about the Confederate flag, because certainly that was the other big issue, the change in South Carolina, particularly Nikki Haley, but then basically coalescing the entire political leadership in the state to bring the Confederate flag down off the Capitol grounds. Certainly the candidates are going to have to respond, particularly the Republicans. How are they going to be able to play that issue, knowing that so many white conservative males in particularly are supportive of that flag?
Well, Nikki Haley and Tim Scott did the Republican field a huge favor, gave them great cover by, standing up and both side by side when Nikki Haley said the flag needs to come down. Among Republicans in South Carolina, Tim Scott has an approval rating over 80%. And among Republicans in South Carolina, Nikki Haley has an approval rating over 70%. So they are both strong with their base. Of course, you know, Nikki Haley has her detractors, but they both are strong with their base. They are both going to be courted nonstop by the Republican candidates. The Republican candidates are already trying to share the stage with Tim Scott as much as they possibly can, not just in South Carolina either. So what they're going to do is – and for those who missed it or don't understand, South Carolina can't just take the flag down. They had to have a procedural vote after the Senate Dai, limited their debate, so they procedurally changed that. On July 6th, I think, is the date they're going to meet, and that's when they'll probably take it down or have the debate and a vote. So they're all going to – all the Republican candidates are going to have to address that, but they're going to be able to say the following. I believe it is up to the state to choose. I believe the state should have their own power. South Carolina chose to take down a symbol that had become divisive, and that's where I stand on it, and then move on. Because remember, they also have to think about that general election where they have to go to the party of Lincoln outside of the mm-hmm. South, and they don't want to be seen as embracing the Confederate flag to the entire rest of the Republican Party around the nation. So I think they have cover because of Nikki Haley, Tim Scott. They're going to have cover because they say, I'm not in favor of the federal government doing anything, but the state chose to take it down. It's the state's right to take it down if it wants. And it did. Next issue.
And real quickly, the white male vote was the most reliable constituency for the Republican Party. And what you have to do is register. You don't really even have to persuade. You have to turn out. And that could help deliver those southern votes that Scott was talking about, bar none.
Jason,
I'd add that some of these tensions run deep, much deeper than just a single flag. The 150th anniversary of Appomattox was back in April, so we asked this question to North Carolinians. As you may know, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant 150 years ago this month. If you had to choose, do you think the Civil War was more about states' rights or more about slavery? Republicans and Democrats are more divided on that question than whites and blacks. So 25% of Democrats said states' rights, 53% of Republicans, as opposed to 28% of blacks and 47% of whites. These divisions about history go deep, and they're deep in these parties.
Okay. The big topic right now that's probably not being talked about, but we'll hear about tomorrow because it's the deadline for the fundraising for all the candidates for this quarter. In 2008, Barack Obama raised and spent $750 million. In 2012, both general election candidates, Obama and Romney, topped $1.7 billion. That's with a B. What is the role of money going to be on both sides? Can Hillary basically wipe Lincoln Chafee and Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley out with a huge haul? And what are Jeb Bush's potential for raising money? And will he be able to basically scare people off, or are they in it for the long haul?
Well, if you think most people, if they're going to run for office, run because they think they can win. And I don't think Foster Freeze supports Rick Santorum. The Koch brothers are kind of let's wait and see. I think the money that Hillary Clinton can amass would say to me, if I were a Democrat candidate, I don't stand a chance. I can ruffle some feathers. I can't buy the kind of exposure that they need. But I think for the Republicans, they're just waiting to see. They can't raise the money that the super PACs can give them. There was a Wall Street Journal poll that said, which I thought was a little curious, but that voters, the most important issue for voters right now is the influence of money. I think that's a snapshot, the kind of meta campaign. And I don't think it will play out the way that Kay Hagan tried to use it the last time around in terms of here's this dark money. Americans are now used to the fact that there are big sources for money, sugar daddies, sugar mamas. But I think the Wall Street Journal saying that said, wouldn't think that was the chief issue. But I think the amount of money means exposure and means really for Hillary Clinton, I can go in and I can have those field offices. Bernie Sanders really only has one office in New Hampshire and is trying to get some more. So it's not just the ads. It's how you can turn out the voters. Obama had the money, but he also had the field operation that would deliver the voters. And that's old fashioned, but it's still important.
Right. And that money is coming in on both sides. I mean, for a while, everybody thought, there's so much of this dark money coming in on the side of Republicans. It was in on both sides, the Democrats as well. Democrats were almost equally matched, actually, in the last election cycle with this kind of, post-Citizens United money. So it's not so much they're buying the elections, which is really what the phrase everybody uses. But what I would like to point out is when these elections are roughly equally matched up with these massive sums of money, What are the topics that are being talked about? Are they the topics that the man on the street wants to talk about? Are they the topics that billionaires want to talk about? Billionaires from both sides. So that money coming in drives the debates in a way that it's just too simple to say you're buying the election. No, you're changing what the election is about, because one side isn't really getting that much more of a bump of this dark money than the other side, but it is fundamentally altering what we are discussing as the issues of campaigns. Maybe not the rhetorical issues that we get people fired up about, but the policy issues that actually move forward after the election.
And certainly being here in Charlotte, we're going to see that spill over from the South Carolina primary because of the media markets and whatnot. Jason, what are your thoughts on where we're going to see the role of money play out in this presidential primary?
I agree with Scott that it's really more of an issue of agenda setting than changing and persuading votes. That said, we will probably see, as we saw in 2014, some of the most expensive campaigns in American history. It's a great time to own a local television station.
Or radio.
Or radio, if it's a for-profit radio station. I think in some ways that the Citizens United was come up, or the court cooked it up in order to save local media. That said, I do think the main effect of this money is not in buying elections, but it is policy agendas after the election. And that, to me, is in some ways more worrisome.
Susan?
Well, I think, as Scott pointed out, it was on both sides. And if it's Hillary Clinton, she can be tarred with the billionaires, the Clinton Foundation, as well as whoever's on the Republican side. So this is not a clear issue that one party can win over the other. I think you're right, Scott. It is an equal opportunity, big money, super PAC, post-Citizens United.
Well, let's talk about a billionaire. Supposedly $9 billion in his pocket. Donald Trump made the announcement that we were all expecting him to do. What is he going to be able to do? I mean, he could conceivably spend $1 billion of his own money if he truly has that. Is he going to be able to kind of shape, you know, the debate going on within the Republican Party?
Let me point out that he is a billionaire because he doesn't spend his own money. He is incredibly good at building up companies that he takes a profit from. And then when they go bankrupt, and I think he's had like 3, 4, 6 go bankrupt, he doesn't take any of the – he's still making a profit from that. So he didn't become a billionaire by spending his own money. So we'll see how much of his own money he spends. As a political scientist, I'm looking forward to seeing him on a debate stage.
But are Republican leaders looking?
I don't.
Well, I think he serves one very clear purpose. There will be no gaffe that will be as great. No oops by Rick Perry can match what Trump said about Mexican Americans who cross the border. He said they're criminals and rapists.
Why is he in this race then? What is motivating him?
Ego.
Well, we're not psychologists. I agree.
I'm not either.
Nobody on the panel is a psychologist. But why is Donald Trump running?
I agree with Susan.
Yeah.
Okay.
So one thing that's interesting is this discrepancy in his net worth between his statements and what Forbes, the magazine that's tracked billionaires over the years, says. So he says that his brand is worth $3.3 billion. Forbes says $250 million. If you become even more famous from running for president, presumably that number could go up.
I am now officially in the race.
Okay. All right. Well, we've heard that. We've got